to sort of test this standard of what qualifies as an excuse. And obviously, the defendants want an excuse in Nettleton, and the plaintiffs don't. But we have to figure out what counts and what doesn't. But Mr. Segarra, why don't you tell us about Nettleton?
The appellant, the plaintiff, sued the defendants or respondents, Steve and Chris Thompson, for injuries that she sustained while visiting. She was invited to the home of the defendant as a prospective renter or buyer. Another plaintiff fell down the stairs leading to the basement and sustained multiple injuries. The plaintiff contends that he did not need to tiny county building code as outlined in the 1976 Uniform Building Code.
Okay, so there's a statutory requirement with what are the things they were supposed to do they didn't do? The building code says thou shalt or thou shalt not, something or other.
There was a standard for having handrails and the stairs had to be a certain width.
Yeah. So a stairway to be in compliance with the code has to have a handrail. And it also, the stairs have to be of a certain dimension, whatever. Okay, so apparently that was violated. And the plaintiff wants to use this to establish negligence as a matter of law. The plaintiff wants the trial judge to grab the jury by the scruff of the neck and say, if you find there was a violation here, that's negligence. Next question, please. Whereas the defendant would prefer what? What does the defendant want?
They wanted to show that they had an excuse.
Yes. And because they had an excuse,
violation. They were ignorant of the facts.
Okay. What's the big issue the jury is going to have to resolve?
Is the excuse valid for negligence?
Yeah. Were they negligent or not? Again, the big issue here is, did the defendant's negligence cause this injury? And the defendant wants the jury to say, no, the defendants weren't negligent. By contrast, again, the plaintiff wants this not even to be an issue for the jury, that the law would force a finding on the part of the jury that the defendants were negligent. What happened at the trial of the case?
The plaintiff filed a motion for partial summary judgment on the question of whether the alleged UBC violation constitutes negligence per se.
Yeah, and again, this is a procedural effort before we get all ready for trial. The plaintiff wants the judge to rule in a pre-trial motion that this is an issue the plaintiff won't even have to prove. Since it's uncontested that this stairwell didn't meet code, the plaintiff wanted the judge to say, therefore, as a matter of law, they're negligent. What happens to that motion?
The district judge, in a memorandum of opinion, held that the defendant was in violation, but he did not find them negligent. He said it was up to a jury to decide.
Okay, so he denied the motion there. He said, even though there's no contest about the violation, there is a question about whether that violation was negligent. I think it's for a jury to decide. What does the jury decide? Well, first of all, what's the defendant's excuse at trial for why they didn't comply with the code?
They introduced evidence that they were unaware of the violations by providing tax records showing that the county assessor or the tax assessor didn't write them up and make them aware of any violations.
Okay, so one of their arguments is that the tax assessor comes through their house in some or has something to do with their house, and doesn't say, oh, by the way, did you realize that you're in violation of the building code? Kind of a goofy argument, actually, isn't it? Why? Because the tax assessor is not there to see whether your copper wire is, in compliance. The tax assessor is trying to figure out what would this house go for on the market and how does it fit into our scheme of taxation. So that seems like kind of a weak argument. But there's another pitch that the plaintiffs made at trial. The defendants made as to why their violation of the building code should be excused.
I believe that was because no one else has been injured.
You're the first people to fall down our stairs.
It wasn't dangerous.
What's that?
They said it wasn't dangerous, no one else has been injured.
Well, that goes to the issue of whether or not the violation itself is negligent or whether the jury could make their own assessment as to whether a stair without a handrail was dangerous. But they also basically said, we didn't know. We were reasonable in not knowing about, who of us walks around? You get invited to somebody's house for dinner and you stand, oh, gee, that's 16 inches over there. That's in compliance with the code. come on. So what the defendants are saying is we should be excused because, excuse me, I didn't know, I wasn't a walking encyclopedia of the from building code. And a reasonable person doesn't have this at their fingertips. Maybe one other feature of this case that has probably occurred to you is that who's the real culprit here? Who's the person who should be paying for the injury sustained here? Mr. Lawley?
Well, the house was built when before the building code was established. And
well, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it
was. It says that it should.
It was 3 years
after.
The builder who put this house, together is the one who should know the building code. For whom it's reasonable, this person should know how wide the steps should be. Maybe the architect who designed it, somebody involved in the construction of this house is culpable. They're not here. Why? They may no longer be in business. There may be a problem with what we find in Chapter 7 statute of code. There are other kinds of reasons why we can't get the real culprit, and as in many tort cases, the person who's most to blame can't be brought to justice, and so we're looking at some third party, in this case, the homeowner. So again, the homeowner's saying, okay, there's a building code, but I didn't know about it, and indeed, when we go back and look at the list of excuses, I think I mentioned them, just before the case itself, there is on page 29, right-hand column, there is an excerpt from the restatement. Now, let me spend a few minutes telling you about restatements because you will encounter them on several occasions through Chapter 1 and elsewhere. And when you start, contracts and civil procedure and other courses, you will have other restatements brought to your attention. There's a group called the American Law Institute, the ALI, a nonprofit organization, doesn't have any official governmental role, but it's a very prestigious institution, sort of like, the Carnegie Foundation or something like that, which the purpose of the American Law Institute is to bring together judges, lawyers, specialists in a particular field, study the law and to try to offer kind of guidance as to where the law is and where it's going. The idea of a restatement is, with all of the cases and the statutes and the commentary out there, after studying all this, can we distill it down into a kind of bite-sized description of the state of the law with respect to various kinds of issues? So, for example, there's a restatement of contract law or the principles of contract. There's a restatement of judgments about the procedure by which judgments are imposed and enforced. There's a restatement of, I think there's a restatement of property law. And there's a restatement of torts. The restatement of torts has had a big impact, as you'll see if you read ahead to Sigler versus Coleman. The Washington Supreme Court in Sigler versus Coleman relies upon a restatement provision. You can actually, the restatement of torts is actually, you know, one, more than one volume. I can't remember how many volumes it's in. But it takes each of these sections, provides commentary. There's also an appendix to the restatement where they cite cases that relied upon the restatement. So there's kind of follow-up to the restatement, where it's been received and approved or disapproved. In any event, the restatement is kind of in a little bit of another world here. It's not like a case. Not like a statute. It doesn't come from a government, from some authoritative body that's binding on anybody. But it has very strong persuasive authority, as we saw in Sigler versus Coleman, where the court will look to the restatement as being a good summary of kind of the mainstream view on this particular issue. I might also point out that when we get to Chapter 9, dealing with product liability, there is a new edition of the restatement working through different areas of the law, and one of the first that they started with was product liability. So there's now a restatement third of product liability, which, unlike the previous restatements, gaining kind of instant acclamation, the restatement third has been bitterly criticized, and many courts have said we're not going to go there. So instead of being this kind of authoritative thing, it's become an object of a considerable amount of controversy. But again, for our purposes here, we sort of treat the restatement as though it gives us a good summary of the law. Now, getting back to Nettleton versus Thompson, if you're the defendant in Nettleton versus Thompson, what do you point out in the restatement list of excuses that seems to most strongly back up the defendant's argument that their violation is excused? Ms. Sharp. Okay. This appears to say that where your ignorance of something, that excuses you. Now, let's look back at Nettleton versus Thompson. Does the court in Nettleton versus Thompson, let's skip now to the bottom line in Nettleton versus Thompson. Mr. Segarra, you were telling us about the procedural history of the case. The plaintiff wanted this determination as a matter of law. The trial judge said, no, I think this is a matter for the jury. And the jury rules in the defendant's favor. And now the plaintiff is appealing that. Or did the judge, Brendan and Gino, change his mind?
No.
Okay. So, So the judgment is entered for the defendant based on the jury verdict, and now the plaintiff appeals and says, essentially in Cardozo fashion, that the jury had no right to dispense the obligation of the Uniform Building Code. What does the Supreme Court of Idaho say?
They held that the plaintiff had proved there was UCC violations.
Which they did.
Which was negligence per se. And that the defendants failed to establish an excuse or justification for violating those standards?
Why wouldn't their excuse fall within this second item in the list? Why didn't the defendants establish that they neither knew nor should know of the occasion for compliance? Ms. Russell? But why isn't that a question for the jury? Didn't the jury say, in effect, well, we think a reasonable person could have had stairs out of compliance with the Uniform Building Code, but simply be unaware of it? I don't wake up in the morning looking around at my house thinking, gee, I wonder what's in violation of the Uniform Building Code. I don't think I'm behaving unreasonably in doing that. This is the defendant's argument. Why is it that the defendants don't get cut any slack with respect to being unaware of the requirements of the Uniform Building Code? Mr. Garrett?
Because they it was a subjective belief and it wasn't objective for the court?
It wasn't objectively reasonable. That's one of the things they did say. Why is it not objectively reasonable to say, I didn't know what the law required me to do? Ms. Griff? Somewhat like the old, Bond versus Menloff, where if the standard is assessing this kind of subjective state of mind, we have an issue with it, but we may also, as a policy matter, be reluctant to give people a break when they claim, but I didn't know the law required me to do this. Did your mother never say to you, ignorance of the law is no excuse? And that would appear to have some bite in this case. To say, in effect, whether you knew about the Uniform Building Code or not, and it turns out to be a pretty difficult question in criminal law. With respect to civil law, making ignorance of the law, or refusing to make ignorance of the law, excuse a violation. But when you get into criminal law and people are being fined or even put in jail because they misjudge what the law required them to do, there are cases where you really question, my goodness, am I being put in jail because I did a bad job of reading the statute, or because after consulting an attorney, I concluded that when it says you can't operate a gambling establishment within 500 feet of a whatever it is, that I thought it meant this, and it turns out the court interprets it to mean something different. And there are all kinds of different explanations when you look at criminal law as to why we will indeed impose criminal liability upon people, even though they persuade us that they didn't know, and quite frankly, we're not prepared to say they should have known that something, some statute meant this rather than that. Nonetheless, the principle followed is that ignorance of the law is no excuse. Now, what is the restatement then saying that an actor is excused if the actor neither knows nor should know of the occasion for compliance? It turns out it's something called ignorance of the fact rather than ignorance of law. If I take an umbrella on my way out thinking it's mine, I can be excused from the crime of theft. If I say, oh, I thought it was my umbrella, if I'm ignorant of the facts, that will excuse. On the other hand, if I say, oh, well, Well, yeah, I knew it was your umbrella, but I thought I could borrow it, that the law didn't treat an unauthorized borrowing. Oh, you mean that's really theft? Oh, well, I'm sorry. I just learned something. To the extent that my excuse is based on saying I didn't know what the law required of me, dead in the water. Whereas if I say I'm ignorant of the fact, it excuses. So in this case, let us suppose the defendants had a railing, but they were in the process of remodeling, and in the process of remodeling, somebody took the railing off. And they thought the workman who took it off put it back on again, but to their surprise, the railing was left off. This person visiting the house falls down the stairs. And they said, we neither knew, nor, as it turns out, reasonably could you expect us to have known, that the railing was missing. I'm not basing my defense on ignorance of the law. I'm basing my defense on the ignorance with respect to compliance or some factual issue. If you stop me on the highway and say, you don't have a working taillight on the left, it appears your taillight, your right taillight's working, but when you put your brakes on, nothing showed up on the left. The law requires you to have two working brake lights, one on the left and one on the right. You can have your behavior excused, depending on the way the statute is written, but if you, hey, I didn't know, thanks for pointing that out, get it fixed. You may get a warning or some other kind of, break on that. So, we're ignorance of the law, we're ignorance of the occasion for compliance is implied, that will work as an excuse. The restatement says so. But the problem in Nettleton versus Thompson is the defense said, we didn't know what the UBC required. And on that point, the courts will say, that's not an objectively reasonable excuse. You cannot, as a matter of public policy, make your ignorance of the law a way of gaining an advantage. Again, one of the explanations, it's not universally accepted as the explanation, but one explanation why we say ignorance of the law is not an excuse is we don't want to reward people for ignorance or, in effect, punish them. The more you know about the law, the worse for you. That would be a perverse situation for all of you, learning so much now about the law. So, there are other reasons you could talk about as to why you do it that way, but that's one. Mr. Christopoulos? Christopoulos, thank you.
How can they be reasonably expected to know?
You can't. That you are reasonable. No one would say, you negligent person, you didn't read the UBC for breakfast. That's not what we're saying, but again, as a policy matter, what you can say is, what kind of a world would it be where the person says, I didn't know this was required of me, gets a break. The person who says, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I didn't know about that requirement, is treated worse. That's, again, one of the sort of policy arguments as to why this, and maybe I grew up in a perverse household, where my mother would say to me, you know, ignorance of the law is no excuse, but it's sort of a common understanding that in fact, we operate on that basis. Again, it's sort of your job, you remain ignorant of the law at your peril, is sort of the notion. And again, to avoid part of it would be, I think, going back to what Ms. Griff said, we're not really so sure these people are as innocent of the law as they claim to be. So, gee, I thought I could borrow your umbrella and bring it back, and that wouldn't be theft. If someone says that, and it's our burden as the prosecutor to show that this person knew about the law, that's a tough burden to put on us to try to have to prove that. So one of the things we want to avoid is the burden on the, or in this case the plaintiff, to show a subjective condition in the defendant's mind, we'd rather put the monkey on their back. But even if they accept the burden and say, I will prove to you everybody's satisfaction that I sincerely didn't know about this, in the end, we would say, tough luck. We can't make that the basis for changing the legal treatment. Glover?
What about then, like in TEDLA, where they kind of allowed, as a matter of policy, like in this case, you're saying that as a matter of policy, they don't allow ignorance to be excused. What about like in TEDLA, where they kind of allowed, if you feel like it's going to be better for you, not follow the statute, then go ahead?
In TEDLA, what they were saying is that I'm fulfilling the spirit of the law, the purpose of the law. I'm actually doing what is sort of the higher purpose of the law. Now, this is a debatable point. I mean, I like to use the illustration about rules that parents tell their teenagers, we're going out, you know, leave the liquor cabinet locked. Now, what did they mean by that? Suppose, for example, some drunken guy came with a knife to, you know, burst into the house and say, give me liquor or I'll kill you. Would my parents want me to give this guy a knife? So what are my parents doing? My parents want me to be happy. They don't understand that in order to be popular with my friends, I need to prove that I can drink alcohol. So, although I acknowledge I'm technically violating what they told me by getting to the liquor cabinet, this is the difference between rationalization and, but we do expect people to sort of compare. I mean, and of course, you know, the Gospels are full of, you know, the letter and the spirit and all that kind of man was made for Sabbath, or the Sabbath was made for man, not man for Sabbath. All these sorts of things where there is the letter of the law, the spirit of the law, it's a complex philosophical moral issue. So, again, in Tedlar versus Ellman, the question arises whether they were doing the right thing or was this just a rationalization, unfortunately, again, for the defendant who wants to nail the plaintiff on that. The judge says, to the extent that there's a colorable excuse here, one which the jury, if they found, was fulfilling the spirit of the law, would operate in that way, we've got to give it to the jury. We can't woodenly say, oh, violates the statute, end of discussion. In Nettleton versus Thompson, on the other hand, the court says we do have to stop woodenly and say violation of the statute because there's no attempt on the defendant's part to say, I was trying to fulfill the purpose of the statute. I actually had, you know, we didn't have a railing, but we had a ramp and we had these other things where we had a person with a wheelchair and the ramp got, you know, this. The railing got in the way because it got hung up on the wheelchair. You know, there wasn't any argument to the effect. I was trying to fulfill the spirit of it. Again, the question about whether it's ignorance of the law or not, is this ignorance of fact or is it ignorance of law? You ask yourself the question, would an absolutely encyclopedic, thorough knowledge of the law have made a difference in the case? If so, you're talking about ignorance of the law. Even if I go to my attorney and I say, I want to start this business, would it be considered a gambling operation? Such that it says you can't have a gambling operation within 500 feet. We're having a, you know, church bingo or we're doing, you know, does this violate the statute? My attorney looks at it and says, oh, gee, this is it. My judgment would be, no, it doesn't violate. Well, even though I follow pretty reasonable procedures, that's still ignorance of the law. If I get the case in criminal law that I always found difficult was, it's a guy who goes into a social club in New York with a firearm, and he's arrested for it. And he's an off-duty corrections officer. And the statute says, you know, it's a crime to go into a social club with a firearm, except for police officers. And the question is he a police officer? He thinks he is. The court says, no, corrections officer is not. Well, excuse me, no. Quite the contrary, your ignorance of the law forms no basis for excusing you. Even though the judges themselves disagree. The majority says it's a violation of the law, the dissent says no it's not, and the majority says ignorance of the law, including our, you know, dissenting colleagues over here, is no excuse. We can put you in jail or, you know, punish you for violating the statute, even though there are people over here who still think what you did was not a crime. I mean, it's kind of bizarre, but again, this is the big debate in criminal law. Why do we say, continue to say, that ignorance of the law does not excuse? Is it because we're worried about these subjective determinations? Is it because, anyway, they're all just a little philosophical excursion in criminal law. But the point is to be able to distinguish ignorance of law from ignorance of fact. If it's ignorance of fact, I didn't know my taillight was out. I didn't know that was your umbrella. I didn't know the railing was gone. Versus, I didn't know the contents of the UBC. If I don't know the contents of the UBC, that's ignorance of law. If I don't know my railing is missing. Or, by contrast with Tegel versus Ellman, I knew this was a violation, but I was trying to comply with the spirit of it, rather than just being cut a break. Well, yeah, you know what, it wasn't so bad. Ms. Stryker? Right.
If you, or the gambling thing, you ask your lawyer. I mean, if you ask your lawyer, what more can you do to find out what the law is?
This is the harshness of the rule. I mean, this is precisely why you get this part of criminal law, and it doesn't make much sense to you to say, no matter how stupid you are, it's a red umbrella and a green umbrella. If I take the wrong umbrella, I can be, you know, I can be excused for that. But if I go to my lawyer and I say, is a gambling institution within 500 feet or whatever, does this, and I make a reasonable judgment, well, screw you, is the answer. So, again, how you can, but in fact, the courts take this hard-line position, again, on differing sorts of rationales, but I don't want to go too far down that road, because after all, it's part of the fun you'll have when you take criminal law, and we do have miles to go here before we sleep. What I want to do here is to take the notes and questions on page 32, and hopefully some of the questions that are still lingering here will get surfaced in the process. Question number one, how do you know whether, or how do you get to a conclusion that there is negligence per se? What are the components of a negligence per se claim? Probably a better way to phrase this would be, what would lead a plaintiff to be optimistic about being able to rely on negligence per se? Three. I'm sorry, what? Okay. There's a statute, and more particularly, that the statute was violated, right? Okay? And this sounds kind of like a no-brainer, but it turns out in many cases you may have a factual dispute over whether the statute was violated. So you have a witness who said the light was green, or the light was red, or that the defendant was going 35 in a 25-mile-an-hour zone, and the evidence regarding the statutory violation is disputed. The defendant says, oh no, the light was green in my direction. Oh no, I was going 25 miles an hour. So before we get to the point of saying, this is negligence per se. We have to figure out, is there uncontested evidence? For example, in Nettleton versus Thompson, the violation of the statute is not really contested. There was no railing on this stairway. There was no light on the buggy in Martin versus Herzog. They were walking on the wrong side of the road in Tedler versus Selman. But there may be other cases in which the fact of the statutory violation is up for grabs. If so, if you had the plaintiff saying the light was red and the defendant says, no, the light was green, what do we do then? Yeah, the jury's got to resolve that factual dispute. So even though, Cardozo's going to grab the jury by the scruff of the neck and make them find something as a matter of law, that presupposes we don't have any jury issue about the underlying fact. What else do we need to know about the case in order to say it's a good one for negligence per se? Mr. Kendall?
That the ordinance must have been intended to prevent the harm which occurred.
Okay. There are actually a series of things. They're often stated as a separate list of items, and I kind of collapsed them all into one general proposition, which was the statute was intended to cover this kind of case. And let me give you an illustration, spoiling the fun, a past exam. In fact, I think it was last winter, in December, the most recent first semester exam that I gave. I took a real case in which a convenience store sold some cigarettes to a bunch of kids who were underage, 15 or 17 or something like that. Or to a kid who walks in and says, I like a box of Marlboro Lights or whatever he has, and they sell it to him. He goes off with his pals. They find a pile of logs someplace. They sort of go behind this pile of logs or climb up on this pile of logs in Southern California someplace. And they start smoking. And one of them drops a lighted match or cigarette or whatever, and the log pile starts on fire. And winds up, they can't put it out, and burns down this whole pile of logs. Is the convenience store subject to a claim because their negligence, there's a statute that says, thou shalt not sell cigarettes to anyone under the age of 18, is their negligence why doesn't that constitute negligence as a matter of law? They may be too, as in other cases like the building, like Nettleton, the real bad guys don't have any money. We're going after the people who do have the money, who have a somewhat tangential relationship. Remembering that there may be more than one proximate cause, could we make the convenience store liable because if they hadn't sold these cigarettes to these kids, they wouldn't have been out smoking them by this log pile? Right. The purpose of the statute did not include the purpose of preventing accidents like this one. The reason we say thou shalt not sell cigarettes to anyone under the age of 18 is we're worried about health problems, so forth and so on. Now, do we know from the statute whether it might have also been with the notion, where do underage kids go to smoke cigarettes? They're often, you know, trying to hide from their parents or from other authority figures. So, you know, they're going to, it's going to, how do we know the legislation? Well, while we're at it, one of the things we'd like to reduce is the number of fires started from minors smoking cigarettes. Ms. Stryker? You could. You'd at least ask the question. It turns out one of the reasons I liked that case and picked it as an exam question was because the trial court bought the idea that it was a violation of statute, therefore the basis of negligence per se, but the appellate court said no. Rereading the statute, they said, first of all, it's found in the section of the statute on statutory title is health and morals, rather than in the section on fire prevention. So, again, in Gores versus Scott, the case that's cited in the notes, you have a statute that says, in transporting sheep, you must keep them, if you're putting sheep on a vessel, you must keep them in pens. And the defendant transported these sheep, didn't put them in pens, along comes a storm, the sheep gets swept overboard. Plaintiff says, you're liable as a matter of law. And the defendant says, no. The reason for that statute was not to keep sheep from getting lost at sea. It was so that there would be isolation and quarantine of infected sheep and they would infect other sheep or human beings or what have you. To help. Now, again, oftentimes you don't know simply reading a statute that says thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that. You have to intuit or guess about its purpose. If it's clear, why is it that we require people to keep a safe following distance when they're on the highway behind another car to reduce the likelihood of collisions? If somebody's following too close and rear-ends somebody else, well, it's pretty obvious the purpose for that statute. Sometimes this is a no-brainer, but sometimes it's a very difficult question. Why did the statute require the sign to be no closer to the center of the roadway than X number of feet? Was it for the purpose of reducing the likelihood that a motorist would strike a billboard? Or was it for highway beautification, so you're not bombarded with the commercial messages that you drive down our beautiful highway? Unless you know what the purpose of the statute is, you at least have to ask the question, gee, I wonder if this would fit within that statutory purpose. If it does, negligence per se may be applied. If it doesn't, then we can't say that the legislature has decreed this for this purpose. Mr. Ortiz?
Would this be for any statute, like motor vehicle code, police code, when you brought up that one case, the criminal case, can you sue something, can you basically damage a case where they violated the criminal code and resulted in injury or damage
to the place of business or whatever? There's actually a very difficult question entailed in what you're asking, and that is, how do we know that the defendant owed a duty to the plaintiff? And let me take on this very difficult question because it has to do with the way you approach the whole subject. Most classical descriptions of tort law divide tort law into four elements. So if you pick up a horn book or you pick up a nutshell or legal outlines, whatever it is, they will say it's duty. If you read a case which describes, the essence of a tort claim, they'll say there are four elements: duty, breach, causation, damages. You will have noticed that I treat these as a single question. And the reason I do that is because if you start with the question, how do I know that the defendant owed a duty to the plaintiff? You're in a big philosophical fog. So, for example, later on in the course, we'll look at a case in which the defendant owned a swimming pool, didn't have a locking gate on the fence. A four-year-old boy gets in the pool to retrieve a ball and drowns. There's a statute requiring you to have, if you have a pool, you have to have a locking gate on the fence. Part of the question is whether that statute generates a duty of care. And your failure to abide by the statute means that anybody injured by that violation is entitled to sue you, or whether you have to have some independent basis for doing that. The case I'm referring to shows up in Chapter 8, and it's tied in with this whole idea about the duty of landowners, which actually takes us back to the introduction. When does a landowner owe a trespasser, as in this case the four-year-old boy is a trespasser, when does the landowner owe this four-year-old boy a duty of care? Now, I've deliberately mushed this together because I think it's easier for you at this early stage of your process of learning how to do all the things you need to do in law school to treat the question as a single one. Because as just to kind of simplify life, most of the time the duty question is easy. When you're driving down the highway, do you have a duty to use reasonable care toward your fellow motorists? Well, of course you do. If you're practicing medicine, do you have a duty to use reasonable care to avoid injury to your patients? Well, of course you do. Most of the cases we're looking at, the duty of care is pretty obvious. That's kind of a no-brainer. And we almost immediately lock on to the second question, well, was that duty of care breached? So I would prefer, essentially, at this stage, to simply say, if the defendant was negligent, or if they should be held strictly liable, those constitute a breach of duty. If you start in the abstract by saying, did the defendant owe the plaintiff a duty of care, as I say, it's like you're up against a 10-foot stainless steel cliff. And you're supposed to get to the top of it. And you just don't have any toe holds to get up there. Whereas if you sort of take the long way around and say, can we identify those cases where the defendant was negligent and whether the defendant should be held strictly liable? If so, that constitutes a breach of duty. So, again, the difficult question which you ask is, how do I know that a criminal statute creates a duty of care on the part of the defendant such that the violation allows a victim to collect damages? And it turns out that question is by no means an easy one to answer. There are lots of people out there who commit crimes, and all the people who arguably are victimized by that in some remote way say, oh, and by the way, when Martha Stewart allegedly engaged in insider trading, do I get to, claim damages from that? So that turns out to be a difficult question. What I'm starting with are sort of the easier questions. Out here in an automobile accident, was the defendant negligent? Somebody falls down the stairs. Was it negligent not to have a railing there? And it turns out we can make progress. We come back to this bigger, difficult philosophical question in Chapter 11, which is, when do I owe a duty of care? And in particular, Chapter 11 deals with those affirmative duties to protect people. I run a weather service. can I be sued because my weather forecast is inaccurate and somebody gets hurt? This is Brown versus U.S. in Chapter 11. Three lobster fishermen listen to the weather report. Sounds like, you know, brisk winds, but it turns out to be a perfect storm. Three of them drown. Can they sue the weather service? The district court said yes. The appellate court said no. But those, I'm postponing these really difficult policy judgments until after we've gotten kind of the bread and butter of motor vehicle accidents and so forth under our belt. Okay, let me just finish this. I'm sorry that Friday things ran over and I'm going to run over just a few minutes here today, but let me just finish this up. Okay, so third aspect. Statute was violated. Statute was intended to cover. The third one I would say is violation was unexcused. Now, in a way, it's the violator's job to prove there was an excuse, but for your analytical purposes, when you're saying, is this a good case for me as a plaintiff to use negligence per se to establish negligence, I would say you should ask these three questions. How confident am I that the statute was violated? How confident am I that the statute that was violated was meant to cover cases like this? And third, does the defendant have a plausible excuse? After I've analyzed that, I can say either, yeah, this looks like a good negligence per se case, or, well, we could try it, but I'm really worried we're not going to make it on issue number three or issue number one or whatever. So,
you know what, I...
Okay, good. I like that. Okay, question number two in the notes here. What happens if negligence per se is found? Mr. Jones.
Then the plaintiff can move on to the next part of the case.
What is the next part of the case?
Causation.
Yeah, now, usually I can get a student to give me the wrong answer, which is, well, then the defendant is liable. Leaving out what you appropriately left in, which is, before we get to the issue of liability, we've got to think about causation. So, yes, the negligence issue is very important, and if negligence per se applies as a matter of law, that ends the discussion about negligence. But we don't move immediately to assessing the amount of damage. We've got to ask this question, well, wait a minute, did the negligence cause the injury? In some cases, it's an easy one. But in other cases, it has its own set of problems. So, for example, in my convenience store cigarette smoking case, there were causation questions in addition to negligence questions. So even if you're satisfied, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, they were negligent, you'd still ask the question, yeah, but was their negligence a proximate cause of the injury? Okay, third question, what happens if negligence per se is not found? Suppose you can't persuade the judge that, as a matter of law, the purpose covered it, or that there's still some issue, and so forth and so on. What happens if you lose the argument on negligence per se? Agreed. Yes, you can still make your case, you just have to sort of go the long way around the block. I mean, you'd like to pick up the card, you know, from Chance or Community Justice as, advanced direction to go, skip all that, but I can still throw the dice and walk my guy around the board. I can still argue to the jury, maybe they weren't negligent per se, or failing to have a railing or something else. But I want to persuade the jury, based on their judgment, that what the defendant did was negligent. And I may have other, as you point out, other arguments. I may be able to point to safety policies of their own. some rule book violation. I may be able to point out industry customers. Don't worry. Okay, we already talked about Gores versus Scott. I want to emphasize number five here, which is not all jurisdictions follow Cardozo's hard line approach. In fact, if I had to say it, the modern inclination is to trust juries more and limit the cases in which their discretion is taken away. In Washington, for example, I think it's DUI and some kind of building code violations that are still a matter of negligence per se, but speeding, for example, is a question for the jury. They have to decide whether speeding was, and under those circumstances, negligent. That's a pretty good argument that it was, but they're not compelled as a matter of law to go there. So there's a jurisdictional split between those jurisdictions that follow Cardozo in this hardline mode of saying juries lack the power to dispense what the legislature has prescribed, as distinguished from those jurisdictions which, like Washington, say, let the jury figure it out. Okay, we'll pick up any more questions on that at the beginning of class tomorrow, and otherwise we'll move immediately to the next one. I don't know, maybe we'll go to the Federal Reserve System. Oh, I really don't know where we'll be at the end of tomorrow. I would... I don't think we're going to get the vicarious liability, but I move as fast as I can. You see me. Basically, the way I've translated it, you have these two issues, negligence and strict liability.
Let me just turn this off here.